Martin, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is Azerbaijani for go straight. A direction a lot of people seem to be following this weekend in regards to escape roads. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me, Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Not too bad. Doing better than a lot of our drivers these days, apparently.
Boy, howdy. You are right. We have a lot to get to today. We'll go through Azerbaijan, and then we'll do our pre-show for Canada. But if you are new to this podcast, a very warm welcome to you. If you're new to Formula One itself, we've got an episode just for you that explains how the sport works and who everybody is. It's our preseason primer. So if you'd like to go back and listen to that, it's episode 178. Also, the show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for our patrons that cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you'd like to support the show and get access to all that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. Usually I would throw it over to Danny here, but Danny is on assignment this week. So I am here to tell you that our next patron-exclusive episode will be a sort of film review, I suppose, is what we call them, of the Eric Bana ode/documentary to his love of rally racing. Rob, have you seen this film?
No, I have not.
Oh, okay. Good. I have, and I'm anxious to see what's
going on. Oh, so it's not new to you. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But we will be recording that later this month and posting it later this month. But in the meantime, I wanted to give a special shout out to our title sponsors over on patreon.com, this time in reverse alphabetical order, starting with your top six dot games, William Rompf, Wealth Energy, Troy Stammer, telemetryduck.com, Tanner McCleave, Sniggs, Pyrites Card Castle, Olivia Evans, Octothorpe Bunny Crimes, Michael Maves, Max Voltar, Jason Kelly, Jason Chadwick, Iron Station Studios, Umberto Roca, Gordy's Army, Gnarly Goat, Erica Siegel, Drew Stewart, David Mule, Circuit Demon, Bailey Foot, Alex Goucher, Alan McCrary, Abraham Getchell, Abdullah Althani, at Team Blackjack, and at Talking Autos. And now, let's take it to the race. Rob, let's just start with the grid here. Qualifying, a little bit of a crazy time. Lance Stroll nosed into the barriers at turn 7 in Q1, then almost immediately after, crashed at turn 2, bringing out the red flag. Everybody then had to scramble in the last 2 minutes 30 seconds, giving us another one of those, you know, kind of a qualifying lap, kind of a race.
But then... I will just note this, by the way. It was a really funny and exciting end to the qualifying. I do not know why the directors on F1 are obsessed with showing the leading car just running alone when, like, there was an actual, like, skirmish happening for, like, qualifying position behind. And it's like, no, by all means, let's watch a car, the leading car, go through the lap alone and completely lose track of what's happening with the McLarens and the Haases. That drove me nuts. Is like, we saw this exciting race to the line, and then it's like, and let's go to the in car to see who was it? Like, was it Leclerc driving solo that we ended up watching? No, he was
Russell or something. Yeah. Especially because in the melee, we only see a yellow flag come out, but Alonso, who was, as time ticked down, sitting in 11th place, and this is Q1, so everyone 16th and below gets knocked out. He goes off into one of the escape roads, bringing out a yellow flag, which, of course, scuppers everybody's time behind him. Is that a Britishism, scuppering? I think I've only heard it in F1, so it may be a Britishism.
I mean, it's something I say, but it might be something I picked up watching F1.
Yeah, interesting. Albon, who was behind that incident and was sitting in 16th place at the time, was not happy with Fernando Alonso going off. He surmised, Albon did, that Alonso did it completely on purpose, just to retain his space in 11th place, or at least in the Q2 positions. And it does look, well, I don't know. There's no way for me to tell in real time.
I was like, okay, whoa, what the hell?
But
the
in-car drives over there.
The in-car was sketchy. Like the way people were losing their cars this week was consistently odd, right? Cause like yeah. they would just lose steering response completely. And you'd sort of see that Alonso seemed to be like really fussing, trying to like get the steering to do something, in the moments leading up to that. But yeah, if I'm Alex Albon, I jump to the same conclusion. It totally looks like a Schumacher-esque, like, I like where the field is at type move.
Right. Yeah, or I think Rosberg famously did it in Monaco. But yeah, especially the Aston Martins seem to have trouble turning corners. Sebastian Vettel nosed into the barriers at turn 15 in Q2, but still managed to make it to Q3. Thankfully for him. But let's just take it down from the top here. The grid for the Azerbaijan Grand Prix looks like this. Charles Leclerc on pole position, the first driver ever to take two pole positions in Baku. Baku famously is unpredictable who's going to get pole, who's going to get the win. Sergio Perez in second place, followed by Max Verstappen. Then the other Ferrari of Carlos Sainz. Then the Mercedes of George Russell in fifth place, followed by Pierre Gasly, having a good qualifying in sixth, then Lewis Hamilton, Yuki Tsunoda in eighth, Sebastian Vettel in ninth, Fernando Alonso rounding out the top 10. Behind him, we've got Lando Norris, Daniel Ricciardo, Esteban Ocon, Zhou Guan Yu, Valtteri Bottas in 15th, then Kevin Magnussen, Alex Albon, Nicholas Latifi, Lance Stroll, and Mick Schumacher in 20th. I can take us through the start, Rob, if unless you have notes here. Not a whole lot happened.
No, you can take it away. I mean, it's really the one pass, right?
Yeah. Kind of a poor start from Charles Leclerc. He locks up into turn one and allows Perez to get by on the inside for the lead. And it's kind of as you were through the rest of it. I feel like that's another one. I feel like Croftyisms are creeping in. I need to assert my independence here, Rob. My American independence.
I was surprised Leclerc had such a bad start. I was surprised that he didn't end up losing another spot to Verstappen. Because, like, he seemed so compromised coming out of one. From that, it, like, you get the AWS thing that says the reaction time was just a little bit slower, but it seemed mostly like it was just, like, the car took a moment finding the gear. But it was, it was a badly compromised start. And also, it was kind of shocking the ease with which then, despite the difference in their quality laps, if you need the illustration between how these cars perform on race day, like, it was very clear, like, from how easily Perez started just kind of pulling out a gap on Leclerc. Yeah. It was really demoralizing if you're Ferrari, and really does sort of raise some questions about like quality setup versus running setup.
Yeah, Sainz even said over the radio, you know, the Red Bulls look quick. And speaking of Carlos Sainz, lap 9 from fourth place, Carlos Sainz goes out of the race with a hydraulic issue. Unlucky once again for him. This will not be the end of Ferrari's bad luck this race. Virtual safety car comes out for Sainz. And a bunch of people pit. Leclerc from second place goes from medium to hard tires. It's a bit of a gamble since it's early, but as you said, Rob, he wasn't exactly challenging Perez. He was kind of pulling away, so Ferrari has to do something here with their last remaining car.
And kind of like the timing on this seemed to work out almost for everyone but Red Bull, or maybe Red Bull, like, just they did have the option to pull in, they didn't. But the fact that it felt like everyone else had the option of taking the not free pit stop necessarily, but like cheap pit stop.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely seemed to promise that there was going to be an interesting difference in tire strategy in the race's middle and later stages. But alas.
Yeah. So Russell from fourth, Gasly from 5th, Hamilton from 6th, Vettel from 7th, Tsunoda from 8th, they all come in. Hamilton has a 3.6 second stop to Vettel behind him, having a 2.8, that allows Vettel to jump Hamilton in the pits. A lot of slow pit stops this race. It was weird.
I don't know what was going on. I wonder if it's the heat. Not just like the fatigue on the... like, when I think of all the times we've had wheels stuck in extreme conditions, I do wonder if it's a progressive thing where, like, in this sort of bad heat, doing the tire change just, like, becomes... there's a higher chance that a wheel's going to take a moment to dismount. I have no idea. But I was also struck by that. It was an odd confluence of slow pit stops this week.
Yeah. The folks that stay out, though, notably the Red Bulls, so they'll be 1 and 2, Perez and Verstappen. Alonso, Norris, and Ricciardo will come out. Or not come out of the pits, but at the end of the pits, they will line up in on track 5th, 6th, and 7th. Ocon also did not pit. He'll be 9th. Just ahead of Sebastian Vettel, who on lap 13 goes for the pass on Ocon and seems to have it in hand, but just overcooks it into turn 3 and has to use the escape route. Kind of a weird one. I don't know if it was just a misjudgment or if that car, you know, I think he said it was qualifying that he had a long brake pedal. So who knows there? I think after the race, he kind of owned up to the fact that that he had messed up, but tough to say. He has to do a spin turn, which I always love.
That was very cool, though.
This was
the most impressive botched missed corner I think I've seen in ages, because it was like he lost one position and arguably he had the chance to not lose any, right? Like he was doing the safe re-entry,
right?
He paused to let Tsunoda pass, but like he could have chanced it. I think it was probably the smart move to not mess with the FIA that way. But I think he might have had a chance to get back in there. But either way, the ease with which he brought that thing back around, pointing the right way. You do not need the reset the track option activated if you are Sebastian Vettel.
Right, you don't need to press the up button.
Yeah,
I think he also did lose a spot to Hamilton.
Yeah, of course.
Ahead of Tsunoda.
Yeah, he was struggling to pass him. What did you make of the Ricciardo-Norris dynamics? This is where it started to surface. That would surface again at the end of the race, right? Where Daniel's on those hards and is coming up behind Lando and notes that, like, I've got more pace. I'm on the harder tire. It's wearing in better. If this is the best Lando's got, I've got more, is sort of what he radios in. It did seem to me like it was one of those clear, like, yeah, different strategies. Like, it did seem like a moment where you maybe wave someone through, and they didn't do anything. And they wouldn't do anything later. I feel like McLaren has odd vibes, is what I would say. And it feels a little bit like the pit wall is really ginger about figuring out how to like call race strategy with these two personalities.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. Like, it's just the whole thing is perplexing with Ricciardo, and I feel like, I don't know, it feels a little like Ricciardo is maybe the like a burr in their side, that, you know, if that was taken out, maybe we'd see a different team, which I hate to say, but that's just kind of the vibe I get. We'll come back to them in a second, but I did want to get through lap 15 here. Verstappen taking the lead from Perez with DRS on the start finish straight. Perez told over the radio, no fighting, so it is a clean move. Verstappen just had the pace there. Perez, I think, also had locked up at one point, so his tires may not have been, or at least the commentators have said, like, he is, or maybe it was DeResta that said, like, he's really pulling away. He's you know, heating up those tires a little bit, so maybe that was why Verstappen was able to close so quickly. Ocon, lap 18, he's still out there on the tires that he started on, and Hamilton, who inherited that place from Vettel, gets him down the inside of turn 3. Verstappen, lap 19, takes his first pit stop from the lead. And again, it's kind of a slow stop. And Leclerc takes over the lead, having pitted already. But instead of seeing how well Verstappen's new hard tires will catch Leclerc's older ones in an interesting strategy race, we are denied that by Leclerc's engine blowing up. Yep. Yet again.
Always something... things always seem to happen as people come on the main straight, too. Maybe it's just the run up the revs as they come down the stress. I don't know, but it was spectacular cloud of blue smoke. Day done.
They
were commenting on the broadcast that Leclerc seemed really gutted by this one. Like he had taken Monaco in stride relatively. And this one hit hard. It's undeniable. Like at this point, the reliability issues are a crisis in Ferrari's season. Just because of the things they're losing with the reliability issues in these races, but as they point out, like this is a team that's already like in the penalty window for taking new power units and new power unit components. So, like, and as we see throughout this like race, like Alfa Romeo's had reliability issues running the same power unit. So there's something bad going on with the otherwise the capable but touchy Ferrari power unit this year.
Yes. So Verstappen inherits the lead there, and around this time is when things heat back up with the McLaren boys. They're chasing down Alonso, who's in fifth. Norris is in sixth, and then Ricardo's behind Norris. Ricardo wants to let pass Norris, but is told to stay there. To which he replies, "If I sit behind any longer, I'm going to get eaten up by Gasly, who's right behind him." Norris soon pits, and then lap 22, Gasly gets past Ricardo for fourth anyway. Or who knows? Ricardo could have cooked his tires behind Norris and that totally compromised him. This race, though, one of Gasly's better performances of this year. I think he should have way more points by now. He's also gotten some bad luck. Gasly's followed a few laps later by Hamilton, who gets by Ricardo on the inside of turn three. Hamilton saying over the radio around this time that his back is killing him due to the porpoising. And it is extremely apparent on the onboard cameras that the Mercedes, Hamilton's car specifically, has it pretty bad.
But Russell's too. And like that camera, like so much worse than any of the other cars. You know how like when you're driving down the highway and like sometimes you'll have that thing where like a window is cracked open in the car and you'll hear, you have like a weird like warble as you're driving along, like almost like sound keeps cutting in and out in your ear as the airflow like keeps getting disrupted passing over it. That's how it sounded, except each one of those little like things corresponds to like the driver being turned into a human bobblehead. At the bottom of the camera angle in a way that's like really, really uncomfortable to watch.
It's not just like the up and down motion. It's bottoming out. So you're hitting the ground.
Yeah.
And there is not a lot of, cushion between you and the asphalt in those cars.
Yeah, it's I was not surprised when he radioed in that, especially because like I've always suspected that he has chronic back issues just from previous seasons where he's sometimes like been really slow getting out of cars, and really ginger with that with his back. So like I think he's kind of the canary, but as we'll discuss in the news segment, it's starting to move into a major issue across the grid.
Yeah, and it's more than just a comfort thing. And thanks to race fans for pulling these quotes. It turns out that because of the porpoising, Hamilton was having to lift a lot in turn 18 and 19, which are normally flat out. And when you're not going full speed, you're not getting maximum downforce over your aerodynamic elements. So on lap 10, he got a snap of oversteer that he managed to correct. But he told his engineer that he thought he was, quote, going to crash at some stage as a result. That apparently got better as the car burned off some of the fuel load, but yikes. And you know, like you said, Rob, there was a shot after the race of him extremely gingerly extracting himself from the car. And he said that, you know, he'll be good for Canada next week, but, you know, Toto even apologized to him over the radio at the end. And a little more of an explanation here. This is a quote from Racing News 365. Quote is from Hamilton. George didn't have the same bouncing that I had. He had a lot less bouncing. I had an experimental part on the car and a different rear suspension. Ultimately, it was the wrong one. So they're trying, but, you know, we will get to maybe some other measures that the teams may be looking at. Same lap. Tsunoda gets by Ocon for seventh. I like this. Says himself over the radio, that was a good move. I like Yuki. At lap 24, Zhou retires with a technical issue, which is unfortunate since he had made it up to 10th from 14th. Another Ferrari-powered car. Not the last one of this race, by the way.
How many retirements has he had this year? Like,
I don't know. It feels like a lot.
It feels like, to the point where it is becoming awkward, I would say. Like, it's one of, like, Bottas has had some issues, right? But it feels like every goddamn race, they're telling him partway through. Yes, that's three retirements this year. Miami, Spain, and this one. Yeah, it's it begins to feel, and I'm sure it's not, but when it's happening on your side of the garage so intensely, you got to start like feeling like what's going on? Like why is his car always the one with the issues?
Yeah. But like I said, not the last Ferrari to go out. Ferrari-powered car, that is. Lap 25, Vettel tries turn three again on Ocon for eighth, and this time seals the deal. And meanwhile, up at the front, Verstappen is told by his engineer to slow down. That is how good this Red Bull is around this track. Just to make sure that his tires make it to the end. And then lap 31 is when we get the other retirement here. Magnussen retires with an issue. The fourth Ferrari-powered car to go out. Only Schumacher and Bottas remain. Lap 36, we get a rearward shot. This was weird. Of Tsunoda's car using DRS, but strangely, only the left half of the wing is opening. Which I had certainly never seen before. I think the commentator said since DRS was introduced in 2011... neither of them had seen it. And it's a dangerous situation because it, you know, it not only, you know, causes like an uneven downforce on the rear of the car. It also, you know, may result in pieces flying off the car and hitting other drivers, which would be bad. So Yuki is shown the rare and elusive black and orange flag, or the meatball, meaning that he has to fix something on his car for safety reasons. So he pulls into the pits and his team just tapes it up. Where's the duct tape?
I hesitate to say I've never seen anything like it because we've seen duct tape deployed to hold cars together before. You see it more in endurance racing. I do feel like I struggle to recall a time in F1 where, like, you see a dad fixed it type solution applied to an F1 car where it's just like, it's fine. It's, what do you want? It sounds like a FIA scrutineer was like racing down there to try to like stop. It seems like they let it go, but it was, I can't recall time. I've seen them just be like, yep, nailed it.
Yeah. It did smack a little bit of, like, I've seen NASCAR pit stops where they bring out a big hammer.
Yeah.
Like, punch of some bodywork.
It didn't even look that well taped. That was the other part, is, like, you know how, like, you expect it'll look like a really well-wrapped bandage, right? Where it's like, yeah, yeah. Okay, that's good work. This didn't, this was like we put a strip of tape over it and just like walked away. It was not good.
I mean, you're on a lot of time.
Yeah.
In the pit stop. The commentators didn't think it would be enough to fix it for the FIA and might earn him a black flag, which would disqualify him, but he was allowed to finish the race. Lap 44, Hamilton has caught up to Gasly in fourth place, tries DRS on the main straight, but no dice, closes up to it in turn two, and finally does get him on the inside of turn three with DRS. Hamilton earning driver of the day for making up those places. Norris on lap 50, we're back to the McLaren battles here. We get some radio saying that... Norris is told to push up to Ricardo, and if Ricardo can't close the gap to Alonso, then they'll let Norris by for a chance at Alonso. But I guess they run out of race to do team orders here, and with one lap to go, Norris is told to hold position. And that's
Well, I'll say that, but that's where the vibes really start to... The way, like, the peevishness of it, like, I don't know, part of it is the Drive to Survive thing still rattling around in my head, and, like, so Lando Norris, horrible child, is now, like, kind of the character he plays, but the race engineer was like, he held position for us earlier in the race, we are returning the favor, and Lando's like, but this is a race position, and it's like,
yeah.
Man, like, I do feel Ricardo's not had a good season for sure. And like, Lando's obviously the primary driver, but the strategy did seem to trash Ricardo's race, right? Like, he was sitting duck when Gasly rolled up on him. It took way too long to get Norris out of his way. Maybe that's because they're hesitant to wade into whatever is the weird lack of chemistry between these guys. But here at the end, it just like it seemed to circle back around to like there is just no. It does not feel like they are a team in any sense. It does not feel like there's a successful team dynamic there at all. It's night and day from when Carlos was driving alongside Lando, but really like. I'm hard-pressed to name a team right now that has worse chemistry that is knocking on to strategy decisions.
Yeah. Well, Ricardo does stay ahead for the finish line, and Verstappen stays ahead of them all. He wins the race, followed by Sergio Perez, and the last podium position, George Russell, Mr. Consistency. Every race this year, he has finished in the top five. He'll get another podium here. Behind him, Lewis Hamilton in fourth, and Pierre Gasly for a great fifth place. Behind him, Sebastian Vettel, and then Fernando Alonso. A couple solid performances from some teams that have just been erratic, to say the least. This year, Aston Martin and Alpine. Then the two McLaren boys, which is better performance here from Daniel Ricciardo in eighth and Lando Norris in ninth. Esteban Ocon, last points paying position in 10th. Then Valtteri Bottas in 11th. He said after the race that something was drastically wrong with his car in this race. He was just kind of nowhere. Didn't do well. I think he qualified 15th. Alex Albon in 12th. Yuki Tsunoda. I mean, hey, the 12th place for a Williams, although I guess four cars did go out. Five, technically. Lance Stroll retired with vibrations late in the race. Alex Albon in 12th, Yuki Tsunoda in 13th, Mick Schumacher in 14th, Nicholas Latifi in 15th. He gained a 5-second time penalty for ignoring blue flags. And we didn't mention at the beginning, a 10-second stop-go penalty for a mechanic touching his car on the grid, trying to roll him back into his grid spot. There's a duration of time when you're on the grid that no one can touch you for safety reasons. And that earned him the worst penalty you can get ahead of disqualification.
Well, in good news, at least he was able to claw back none of it. It's like, Every week now, increasingly, I have a moment where I'm like, Nicholas Latifi, what are you doing here? Like, it's it's not going well. And the difference between him and Albin also seems pretty stark. You know, even by pay driver standards, like, this seems like it's a... it seems grim. And I don't think Lance is tearing it up either. To be clear, like, it feels like that car. Dre Harrison over at Motorsport 101 was commenting that he has a suspicion that the Aston isn't that good a car, and that Vettel's actually putting the other bit of a lights out performance, achieving what he's managing to with that car. But I do feel like Stroll is also not having a year where it's like, I'm doing my part is not really the operative phrase when I think of the pay driver guys.
And the DNFs from this race: Lance Stroll in 16th. Then we've got Kevin Magnussen, Zhou Guanyu, Charles Leclerc, and Carlos Sainz. Perez, fastest lap. And that was Baku. Shall we take it to some news here, Rob?
Yeah.
Why don't you kick it off with, we've talked a lot about porpoising in the race, specifically around Hamilton, but most everyone is having some problems with this. What is that leading to?
Well, I mean, it might not be leading to much, is the thing. So, but it is becoming an increasing point of emphasis among the drivers, at least. Apparently, the Grand Prix Drivers Association have asked the FIA to look at the porpoising phenomenon and its likely impacts on health. Autosport had an article covering the fact that this issue arose during negotiations last year, where there was a suspicion that porpoising would become an issue, and there was a proposal to mandate ride height requirements that was shot down, which is going to be the story of this entire thing, which is the teams will chase performance no matter what, especially the teams that think they can succeed under these rules. And so there's not a lot of energy around like imposing requirements that on the thing that will reduce porpoising. But Russell's complaining. Hamilton obviously sort of came out of this remarking that he was iffy for the Canadian Grand Prix, or at least Wolf said that. Hamilton clarified he's gonna race in Canada. But you know, Carlos Sainz has, and Ferrari seems to have a car that handles this okay. Doesn't matter. Carlos Sainz is unhappy about the porpoising situation. Gasly came out of this with really strong remarks. He said, everyone's got to save us from ending up with a cane at 30 years old. The rest of the quote is, it's not healthy, that's for sure. I've had a physio session before and after every session just because my spinal discs are suffering from it. You literally have no suspension. It just hits going through your spine. And I'll always do it because I'm a driver and I always go for the fastest car I can, but I don't think the FIA should put us in a corner where you got to deal between health and performance. This did come up in the previous ground effect era. It's just not well appreciated because that era ended really quickly, and so there wasn't a ton of, like, I think in the past it's been discussed in terms of like how did teams solve this issue. It's not clear that all of them did, but it cropped up the last time cars did this, and here we are again. Horner kind of representing the position of teams that are succeeding here. Had a typically blunt quote from Christian that parts of it were taken out of context, where he was it was framed as he was accusing Mercedes of telling their drivers to bitch on the radio about the issue. The actual context was he was asked, if you were team principal over at Mercedes and had a car doing like this, what would you do? And he said, I would tell my drivers to bitch about this over the radio and, like, publicize this as a safety issue in the hope of, like, driving a change that would make us more competitive. His the other quote he gave during interviews around this topic was, you should never run a car that's unsafe. But I think that's more for the technical guys, because certain cars have issues, and there are some cars that have very few issues. So it would seem unfair to penalize the ones that have done a decent job versus the ones that have perhaps missed the target slightly. And the other thing he pointed out in that quote, in that interview, was that this is under the team's controls. There's nothing saying they can't increase ride height. They're just choosing not to.
Because that would make their car slower.
Right. So it's a classic F1 mess where everyone's chasing performance and really unwilling to compromise it, even though there's like some clear and increasingly salient downsides to it. You got what seems like maybe only one team that really has like licked this issue, which is the Red Bull design, where they're not fighting the car in this way. I don't know. I gotta believe there's a solution to this. Engineering wise, maybe eventually they'll figure out what a solution is in terms of like designing aerodynamics. But I do wonder if there is a solution where you could put some sort of they can measure everything right on these cars. They measure all sorts of they measure the G impact, like translating to the driver in sort of the vertical motion of the car. I do wonder if you just institute a safety requirement along those lines, where like if you cross this threshold, you can't run the car. But it feels like this is a sport where everything is measured. Everything that happens physically to and within a car has some piece of telemetry data that shows it happening. And so I think this does feel like a situation where they're going to have to take this out of the team's hands. And they're going to take it out of the driver's hands, because I think Gasly's right. No driver is going to say, yeah, run the slower car, my back hurts. They are all wired to say, I will do whatever it takes. I want the performance. I'd rather have a fast car. I think the obligation of an organization like the FIA is to... this is why we need governments, folks. You need to take decisions away from people who are unable to make a safe and responsible decision due to other competing interests that are like built into the operation of their role or the company. And I think that's where the FIA needs to get with this. But it feels like they're gonna, you know, we're deep into the season and they're still at the point where it's like maybe we should do something, and it just looks agonizing.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, definitely a story to watch for sure. I don't like seeing it. It's like it not only looks painful, it looks like, I don't know, amateurish to see cars just bouncing around. And
yeah,
doesn't look cool.
I was kind of thinking about the obviously vastly different scales of the thing we're talking about, but I was kind of thinking about this in connection to the Isle of Man TT discourse.
Yeah.
Which is that one argument is always everyone knows what they're signing up to in these situations. You know, it's an assumption of risk, and to an extent, you shouldn't sweat it that much when those risks, when the cost of those risks come due, and like that's true up to a point. But again, I think just because people are willing to put themselves in harm's way and even like endure extreme risk, just because people are willing to do that doesn't mean that like you as a society or like a governing body or a sport necessarily should like let them do that. That's not a good enough reason to say like, you know, they're fine with it, so what have we to worry about it? Just because you're always going to find someone willing to risk their life or destroy their health to do something they love doesn't necessarily mean that you should actually let them. And that's kind of where I'm at with stuff like this, where it feels like there's some pretty easy things we can do in cases like this to mitigate the risk. that won't like, certainly aren't going to ruin the sport, but it's just a cultural hesitation and slowness to tackle these problems head on and impose regulations on decisions that are by tradition just like left to individuals or individual teams.
Yeah, and I think if they were to put some rule through that, I get what Horner is saying. Like, we did it right, so why should we be punished? Doing so would not be how Formula One usually does things, and this is an extenuating circumstance, yeah. Right? Like, it's harming drivers. It's not fun to watch. I don't think there's like a slippery slope argument to be made here.
I think first of all, like, I think anytime you say, like, anytime somebody pulls out a slippery slope argument, like, I think you're about to, you just need to brace yourself for a crock of shit, right? Because it's always like, we can't do this obviously sensible thing because in this like wild hypothetical, the same principle could be used to justify. No, we're not discussing principles here. We're discussing like a pretty clear problem. Also, but I am sensitive to, it does appear like Red Bull nailed it. Like Red Bull built the best car. They should be allowed to like reap the benefit of that. That's pretty fundamental to F1.
Yeah.
Which is why my preferred solution would be, if the other teams can't run cars without like wrecking their driver's spines, they shouldn't be allowed to run those setups. And like, if that means they watch Red Bull drive away, and we return to the bad old days of like Vettel just like sprinting away into the distance, fine. F1 goes that way. You know, this happens routinely. They nailed it. Adrian Newey did it again. Everyone else have a great fight for second and third in the constructors. But the notion that Mercedes' mediocre performance, even with these ride heights that they're running, justifies doing this to Lewis Hamilton and George Russell is absurd. Yeah. They finished third and fourth this week, but like really, they shouldn't have. they lucked into that. So like, what's this really worth? Especially if you're Hamilton, like why do this to your body in an uncompetitive car?
Yeah. Well, speaking of struggles elsewhere, what's going on with Mick Schumacher and the Haas team?
Well, it's, you know, there's been a strange thing, this sense of the room is turned on Mick Schumacher, that he keeps having crashes and issues, and he does. Gunther Steiner gave a really interesting interview about it, kind of discussing it from multiple angles. It's Autosport has a good write up of it. Gunther, it's not possible for Schumacher to continue run of crashes, but that's not the only thing that Steiner said. And if you read it, you'd absolutely hear it in Steiner's voice, because he's sort of in his hyperactive way examining it from multiple angles. One, it's a problem. Two, he doesn't like talk to Mick about it much, because he's like, Mick knows this is a problem. I don't need, if I tell Mick that I think it's a problem, he should stop doing it, I'm going to make the situation worse. Actually, the real problem is Mick keeps reading the papers and coming to me thinking he's like ruining their team. and he's like, I don't know. He's like, I don't know what this really costs. The paper's reporting stuff. But it's not something that Steiner is necessarily sweating. The bigger issue is that, beyond the cost cap, Haas is dependent on Dallara and Ferrari parts. And when they are burning through equipment, rebuilding cars after crashes, they're burning through they're burning through their stock of parts from their two like critical manufacturing partners. Like this has always been the weak point of the Haas operation. They don't really build very much for themselves. And so the crisis that like Mick's accidents have caused is that Dallara and Ferrari cannot produce the material to keep Haas cars running on track with like the latest components at the rate that the Haas team and primarily Mick are like shredding these cars. So that's the real thing they're up against is like it's a cost concern, but actually it is a logistical crisis that it's caused. But it's an interesting interview, I think, in part because it indicates it illustrates a lot about Steiner's management style and like how like the way being supportive comes across from him, which is to be really blunt to the press, like, yeah, he's fucking up. Also, we don't need to talk to him about that because he's already in his head about it. So why discuss it? Why put him more in his head? And I don't know if he's always been that way or if this is a if this is an evolution since reflecting on like how things panned out with Roman.
Interesting. Yeah. Oh, I like Mick. I hope he turns it around. Well, we may be looking for, I know Formula One is looking for some new racetracks because we lost the Russian Grand Prix this year. That will not be replaced this year, but in the future, we will need some replacements. One continent that has been overlooked for many years, Africa. Hey, maybe we should have a race in Africa. There's a lot of people there. South Africa last hosted a Grand Prix at the, and I don't know how to pronounce this, Kialami track.
That's how I've always
heard it. In 93. Having returned there, this is from Autosport. They staged the race between 67 and 85 before returning in 1992 following the end of apartheid. And then looks like they had a 93 race and haven't been back since. Formula One CEO and President Stefano Domenicali has traveled to South Africa, where he is set to meet with Kialami officials and other stakeholders for further talks about reviving the race. Initially, when the rumors were surrounding this, it was said that it wouldn't be before 2025. However, because of this new development, I think with Russia, we could see it next year, 2023. There is a 24 race limit currently enforced by the Concorde Agreement between Formula One and the FIA. But look forward to that, I guess. I would love to see. I don't know anything about the Kialami track. I'm sure there are some onboards on YouTube. Maybe I'll try to find one and put it in the show notes. I don't know. It would be nice to have representation on that continent where virtually every other one, aside from Antarctica, has one.
Though I will say, like, the politics that are interesting because, like, so basically the era of the Grand Prix in South Africa is, yeah, it corresponds with apartheid, right? And so on the one hand, like, I am very sympathetic to the notion that, like, yeah, this should be an issue from the standpoint of representation. There should be a race or races in Africa. But also I do kind of wonder how that intersects with like the realities of South Africa. I don't know, right? I do not know very much about like the current state of South Africa or like where the political settlements are there. But it is one of those things that I do hesitate a little bit when it's proposed as kind of a, in some ways a way of addressing like racial disparity and inequality in motorsport. Oh, well, we'll go race in South Africa. And it's like, from a certain point of view, that also is we're going to go race in a place that like through history also symbolizes a lot of those same issues. So I am curious like to what degree this would be like the right settlement. I wonder. I also don't know if there's a ton of other motorsports facilities in Africa south of the Sahara. But
yeah, Autosport points out that even Kialami is technically a FIA grade 2, so it will have to be upgraded to a grade 1 in order to host that, and that'll take some cash, but you know, it is possible. And real quick here, Rob, you've got some stuff to say about Spa.
Yeah, just Spa is also struggling to maintain its spot on the calendar. And the Autosport write-up is basically that Liberty has an idea of what a Grand Prix weekend should be, which is that it's a destination race. The quote from the article is, the Americans are determined to turn every Grand Prix into a mini Super Bowl, bling and all, whether that suits traditional race fans and venues or not. In contract talks with Spa Grand Prix, the government-backed organization behind the Belgian GP, F1 CEO Stefano Domenicali and his team have made it crystal clear that Spa is expected to follow the same entertainment-driven concept if it wants to have a future. And Spa is willing to buy into that idea. And they go on to talk about, like, Spa is trying to explain how they're going to... Yeah, they'll have DJs and concerts. There'll be a whole, series of events on Grand Prix weekend. But the thing they can't get around is the fact that, like, it's a small community in the Ardennes Forest. Like, it's not easy to get people in and out of. I don't know if that should necessarily be a disqualifying thing, but by all accounts, like, the Miami Grand Prix was also a shit show to get in and out of. Like, the issue with this model of racing event is that you're bringing tons of people into spaces that don't really have capacity to move them in and out easily. But, man, it, like, reading stuff like this is just... It's a bummer, honestly, like, that Liberty Media has done a lot of good things with F1, but also seems to have this really blinkered, like, one-size-fits-all approach to, like, this is what F1 should be. It's all image, it's all style, and not necessarily substance. And it does remind me a little bit of the 2000s when NASCAR was... you know, treated as this, like, ascendant, cultural phenomenon, you know, and, it, you know, obviously that moment will never fade. And it did. And I think one way you do it is through saturation and sort of imposing a sameness to things, mm-hmm. which is what I worry Liberty, that is the future that Liberty is pointing towards.
Yeah. Well, why don't we take it to Canada here for the end of the episode? And I'm going to be a little quiet because I've got a jackhammer going on just outside. So take it away, Rob. Tell us about Circuit Gilles Villeneuve.
Yeah. So this is one of the rare old F1 circuits that really hasn't changed very much over the years. Usually the history of these things is the history of, like, upgrading and refining circuit layout. That process in the case of the Canadian Grand Prix happened when they moved it to Circuit de Gilles Villeneuve. Previously, they raced at a facility in Toronto that was just apparently not really fit for F1, and following a series of issues with a number of races there, they moved it to this facility in Montreal. This is one of the fastest circuits on the calendar. It is a race where you will see, like, the smallest wings they run in F1 because it has some incredibly long flat out sections across its 4.3 kilometer length. The first sector is really the one where you have the most. It's the most technical sector in terms of corners. You have a short run to a quick left-hander, and then the racing circuit sort of unfolds in a series of, like, long sweeping curves with some hard braking zones throughout the first sector. And then it begins to open up a bit because the entire circuit is kind of elongated on this narrow island in the St. Lawrence. And so, you know, throughout sector two, you are running across a series of, by the standards of this circuit, short straights, but they're kind of medium-sized straights. Turn eight terminates in a hard right and then a hard left, setting up another straight. And then you come to a really sharp hairpin at turn 10, where everything sort of comes to a screeching halt, and it's really important to get this right, because out of turn 10, you go on to really the signature of the track, which is this long flat out section. It's a straight with a small kink that like is turn 11, but it's not really a turn. You just take it flat, and the cars get up to I think this might still, especially since they're not running Shanghai, I think this still might be the fastest in a straight line you see the cars get in F1. All of that comes with a little bit of risk. When you come to the end of the straight, it terminates in a very dramatic right-left-hand chicane. Coming through it, you want to take it as fast as possible, but it does mean that accelerating out of the chicane will often, if you get it just a little bit wrong, you will end up burying your car in the Wall of Champions. Or, if you do it right, your tire may just kiss the Wall of Champions. And you will see it during the racing weekend, because probably by practice 3, there will be a sort of rubbered in strip along that wall from all the cars smacking and grazing the wall. But that's kind of the signature of this track. It's certainly like one of my favorite venues. Honestly, I think it's such a unique F1 venue. Just because of the speeds, it's you play racing sims. It's one of the easier ones to drive, and it's generated some absolutely great races. I think one of the all timers. I tend to bring it up again and again, but in 2011, Jenson Button had to drive from the back of the field after a restart on lap 41 and ended up winning the race. His front to back victory for Button, probably one of the best of his career, and one of the most memorable that feels like could only happen at a place where as rife with overtaking opportunities as Gilles Villeneuve is.
Yeah. All right. Well, fantastic overview. I'm going to try to get through the rest of this here before the jackhammer starts up again. The weather for Circuit Gilles Villeneuve seems to be a little cooler than we have been seeing, about 67 on qualifying day Fahrenheit or 19 Celsius. Precipitation 15% on that qualifying day. Sunday, though, same amount of precipitation, 15%. And slightly warmer temperatures. All right, there it goes. I'm just gonna keep going here. Drivers' Championship. Let's run down the field, shall we? Max Verstappen is on top with 150 points to Sergio Perez's 129. He jumps up a place after the Azerbaijan Grand Prix, 13 points ahead of Charles Leclerc in third. George Russell's in fourth with 99 points. Carlos Sainz is in fifth with 83. Lewis Hamilton in sixth with 62. Lando Norris has 50. Valtteri Bottas has 40. Esteban Ocon has 31. And then we've got a tie between Pierre Gasly and Fernando Alonso at 16 points. They both jump three positions with their strong finishes in Azerbaijan. Daniel Ricciardo is in 12th with 15 points, tied with Kevin Magnussen. Sebastian Vettel is in 14th place with 13 points. Yuki Tsunoda is in 15th with 11. Alex Albon is in 16th with 3 points. Lance Stroll has 2. Zhou Guanyu has 1. And then a three-way tie between Mick Schumacher, Nicholas Latifi, and Nico Hülkenberg. In the constructor standings, Red Bull is on top with 279. Ferrari's got 199. That is an 80-point gulf. Mercedes is in 3rd place with 161. McLaren has 65. Alpine has 47 in 5th place. Then we've got Alfa Romeo in 41, Alfa Tauri with 27, Gene Haas and team, 15 points, tied with Aston Martin, and finally Williams with 3. If you yourself want to join the leaderboards, you can do so using the code in the show notes for the Shift F1 Formula 1 Fantasy League. I'm going to read down the top 3 in both the Azerbaijan and the overall standings. Azerbaijan in... I'm going to go with... the third, again, there's a zero here. So I'm going to go 3-2-1-0. In third place, Kai from the United States with the team Too Fast, Too Furious in honor of Yuki Tsunoda. Nick from New Zealand, Nico Team 3 is in second place in Azerbaijan. And in first place from Austria, Marcus with the team Hasser Bulla. Hasser spelled with an S-set. Mm-hmm. In zeroth place, Peter from the UK. Now we are a flippin' bunch of bankers. Overall, though, our overall standings, there is no zero. There is only third place from America, Andy's team. Now this is pod racing. And then a tie at the top between two Canadians, Jeremy with the team What's Verstappening to Me, and Michael's team, Leo Speed. You can send us an email at shiftf1podcast@gmail.com if you like, or f1.cool/emails. You can also hit us up on Twitter at shiftf1podcast. I'm at Drew Scanlon. That is at Rob Zachney. Danny O'Dwyer is at Danny O'Dwyer. That is us around the internet. And now let's take it around the world of racing. DTM. Oh, yes. They are back at Imola at the Autodromo Enzo di Dino Ferrari. The Camping World Trucks are holding down the NASCAR fort because Sprint Cup, or I'm sorry, the Sprint Cup and the Xfinity Series are not racing this weekend. It's only the trucks at Knoxville Raceway in Knoxville, Iowa. Okay. The Repco Supercars are at the Hidden Valley Racetrack. Grab your ranch.
Yeah, I was thinking like the dressing.
Yeah. MotoGP is at the Sachsenring for the Motorrad Grand Prix Deutschland. Super Formula is back at Sportsland Sugo in the... Oh, boy. It's all in Japanese, Rob. I have to look this up. Danny would be very upset with me if I didn't tell you what prefecture it was in. Usually it's listed here. It is in the town of Miraga in the Shibata District, Miyagi Prefecture. And we've got Formula One. What do you know? Friday, June 17th, Free Practice 1 kicks off at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on ESPNU, followed by Free Practice 2 at 5 p.m., also on ESPNU. Following day, Saturday, June 18th, Free Practice 3 is 1 p.m. Eastern Time on ESPN2, followed by qualifying at 4 p.m., also on ESPN2. But the race, everyone, Sunday, June 19th at 2 p.m. on ABC. Get those rabbit ears ready. Yes. I'm sorry. I forgot to tell everyone what the Camping World Truck race was called. It is the Clean Harbors 150. Keep your harbors clean. Everyone. Just a PSA. All right. Well, final thoughts after Azerbaijan and ahead of Canada, Rob.
I mean, it's increasingly feels like nobody can touch Red Bull at this point.
Yeah.
This is close to a runaway situation unless Ferrari can somehow fix their reliability and figure out a car setup that will be good over the distance on race day. But it certainly feels like Red Bull nailed the new regulations, have the best car, two great drivers. It's going to be real hard for everyone to bring the fight back to them in any meaningful sense. Hopefully, and honestly, at this point, I'd rather see them mitigate the porpoising issue probably than anything else.
Yeah. Well, if you'd like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes and the official Shift F1 Discord, you can do so over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.